Taylor is speaking with Charles W. Lerner, newly resigned secretary of the faculty of the University of Wisconsin-Madison.
Mr. Lerner, I think I would like to begin this morning by having you say a little bit about your early background, leading up something about your education and leading up to your position on the faculty at the University of Wisconsin.
Well, my education was I lived in South Dakota when I went to college. Went to South Dakota State College, where I got a bachelor's degree and a master's degree, and then in 1937 I came down to the University of Wisconsin, where I stayed until 1940. I was in agricultural economics as a graduate assistant. I did most of my work for the PhD by 1940, and then I left and came back to finish it a little bit later.
So this was about the time of the war, was it not?
Yeah.
Getting close.
I go back further, I suppose. My roots are in Wisconsin, are really pretty deep. There's a little country churchyard down by Millard, where my great-great-grandfather and my great-grandparents and my grandfather are buried. Oh, then they came from, I'd say, probably fairly prosperous Wisconsin farmers, and my dad went to school here at the university in engineering, a civil engineer. After he finished, he took jobs in Canada, where I was born, and then in Montana, and floated around. We ended up in South Dakota.
How long have you lived in Wisconsin?
I was born in Canada.
Oh, I see. So.
And lived around. I lived mostly in Pierre, South Dakota. That's where I grew up. That's where my high school and hometown is located. My work here in ag economics. I had a research assistantship. Finished in 1940, and then I went, I finished my prelims, and then I took a job with the United States Department of Agriculture, a job that had me what we call out in the field most of the time. I spent some time in Montana, some time in Lincoln, Nebraska, and so on. I had a glorious time for a little while, and then the war broke out, and I went into the Navy. I volunteered and got a commission at the Naval Reserve, and I had 4 years, and when I got out of that, I went back to Washington, where I spent about a year, and at about that time, I got the offer to come to Wisconsin. And I got here with the idea, probably, that I was going to stay. I mean, this is where I really wanted to be. I should mention one of the influences here. I was out in South Dakota when a kind of a flashy young fellow from University of Wisconsin showed up. This was Raymond Penn, one of my good friends who's been here in college, been here for a long time. He's now retired. And I was quite taken with Ray, and we spent quite a little time together, and I became he was my advisor, and he was largely instrumental in steering me toward Wisconsin. That's the only place I wanted to go, so I was quite pleased to get down here. Well, now, let's see, after the war, I went back to Washington, where I worked for the United States Department of Agriculture for about a year. Did not like it. It was not a happy time. And then I had a chance to come here. I came here as an associate professor in 1947, so that gives me quite a long time on the tenured faculty here.
Yes, you came with tenure right away.
I might say, for the record, I'm 63. I was born in 1914, so I'm 63 now. Since we're kind of interested in the faculty government part, I must say that I suppose for the first 20 years I was here on the faculty, I didn't really have very much to do with faculty government. I went to a few faculty meetings, which I found rather boring. They were always, my office was in Ag Hall. The faculty meetings were always held in some unfamiliar part of the campus, and most of the people who went to the faculty meetings were people I had perhaps heard of, but I didn't know, and they were not my associates and so on, so I didn't go to very many faculty meetings even. I think I got into faculty government, into faculty business by way of committees, which I think is probably the normal route for most people. I was a member, let's see, I was an elected member of the library committee at one time. And I cannot remember the years, although I can probably look it up. But, I think back of that experience, and I think all of these things add up a little bit to your background.
Oh, sure.
I learned something in that library committee in that fairly brief and not memorable experience that I think I've used in later years. We have a number of committees that are essentially set up to be advisory, to be policy formulating groups for some kind of a program on the campus. In this case, the library.
Was this before Memorial Library was built or after?
After. When was that built? That was
in the early 50s.
Yeah. This was after the Memorial Library had been built, but it was a committee that I think even now consists of elected faculty members and a couple of deans appointed by the chancellor and the director of libraries. And one of the things I have managed to do, and since I've become secretary of the faculty in some of these committees, is to get a committee like this, get the person who's running the show, get him on the committee as a consultant rather than as a voting member, because I mean, the committee is really supposed to be setting policy for the whole thing. So it's kind of difficult to avoid being something of a rubber stamp for somebody who's full-time and aggressive and interested in the program. Anyway, that's one thing I picked out of that. I was also a member of the Social Studies Divisional Executive Committee at one time. I can't remember. I can't believe it was for 3 years. I could look it up, but did not seem to be that long. Leon Epstein was the chairman at that time, and I'd known Leon for a long time, but this was the first time I had seen him in kind of professional action, and I then developed the kind of respect for him that I still have. I mean, he's very bright, and he does a lot of does his homework very well, and he's well organized, and he keeps things moving and decisive, and it was a good experience in that respect. I don't remember much about it otherwise. Well, it was I don't really realize or know why it came about, but I was put up and elected to the university committee to a three-year term. I was elected in May 1967, and I think like most people elected to the university committee, I had no idea what it meant, except that it was a well-known committee, and you know, the commonly referred to as the prestigious or the all-powerful or something like that. It was something to get on the university committee.
Well, it's still that, considered that.
But but you don't really know what it means. And what it really means is that you get terribly involved in a lot of things. It takes a lot of time, and it's quite an experience for anybody. James Villamont of Engineering was the chairman at the time I was elected. That was in May of 1967. The next year, the chairman was Eugene Cameron. I'll try to keep my dates straight, but they kind of went like this. I was a member of the university committee during 1967 and 68. I was a chairman in 68, 69, and then in 69, 70, I became secretary of the faculty, mm-hmm. So it was a kind of crowded period there. So
things sort of happened a bit fast, didn't they, in terms of changes for you?
Well, things happen fast. I think back and try to remember what... I don't remember anything about that first spring under Jim Villamont, except that I got quite familiar with the other members of the committee. But we were having some problems on the campus at that time. There was the Dow Chemical interview riots. The first ones had taken place, and I remember a big meeting at the Union Theater in February '67 when then Chancellor Fleming
talked to a large number of the faculty. This was an audience of 800 or something like that, about the Dow Chemical interviews. And there were several meetings that spring on the placement policy, placement service policy, and whether we should have placement interviews and those things. Many of them connected with some of the early disorders. And of course, it wasn't really until the next fall that these things happened.
As I recall, 67, 68 was a pretty stormy year in terms of...
Well, it was a big change. Fleming left and Bill Sewell became chancellor, and in October, the first regular meeting of the faculty, at which, as a new chancellor, he made his address to the faculty. The university committee at that same meeting of the faculty appointed a committee to examine the role of students in the government of the university. This was a committee that was under the James Crowe genetics. This was the Crowe committee, and I forgot the exact name of the committee, but that was the first one, and we were at that time making some kind of an effort to accommodate to what was obviously some kind of disorder here.
Well, there was some pressure from the student body, wasn't there?
There had been quite a little pressure from the Student Senate, Wisconsin Student Association, for more active involvement of the students. It was a student power push, and they wanted to be on committees, and they wanted more authority in the university. But it was a kind of it was in more abstract terms than those, and it was not until we really had some disorders that all of a sudden this began to have a great deal of meaning. The dates here, October 2nd was the date that Sewell made his first address to the faculty, and on the 19th of October, and this was 67, there was a special meeting to talk about the disorders, the big riots that had taken place at the Commerce Building, I think the day before, probably the 18th. There were a couple of long meetings at that time. There was a meeting, took place in the Union Theater. There were, my notes, 1,350 people at the first meeting, which was on October 19th, and then we went from 3:30 to about 5:30, and then we recessed and went back and stayed until 11:45 that night. For the second session, we still had 1,250 people, so that was a big crowd, and it was a big riotous, stormy, troubled meeting. Then there was another session on the 23rd, which would be 3 days, 4 days later, at which we established another committee, the Merman Committee. Sam Merman, of the law school, was the chairman of this committee that was to study the role of, the Crowe Committee was on the role of students. The Merman Committee was on modes of meeting obstruction of university activities or something like that. Mm-hmm. They really ended up dealing with the same thing. There were two committees working side by side, both of them with students, and they actually came out and reported and pretty much were handled one batch. But the Crowe Committee was before, and the Merman Committee was after the disorder, after the Commerce School disorders had actually taken place.
I see.
That was an even bigger meeting, by the way. 1,450 people. These were the meetings that in some ways led to the creation of the Faculty Senate, because we had these enormous numbers of people. We had hardly any place on the campus that was big enough to handle all the faculty people that came to these meetings.
I was interested in that, how this all came about. Do go into that.
I will. These meetings, when you went, I looked over the notes here the other day. It's difficult at this stage to see what we actually did, but one of the things we did was get together and talk about it a great deal and make some kind of adjustments to, we changed some of our programs. We made some adaptations in structure and in programming and that sort of thing, but for the most part, well, they were big meetings at which a lot of people got together and expressed their concern and different viewpoints and so on. it was, they were too large to be meetings at which you could really say you were going to conduct business. They were kind of like a town meeting in which the town population had got so big you couldn't get them in a hall, and something like that. And not everybody who wanted to had a chance to speak, and I think most of the views were fairly well expressed in these long meetings, but they were pretty large and disordered. They were simply too large a scale for really effective legislative operation, which I never have thought was their real purpose anyway. We weren't getting together to legislate, we were getting together to talk these things over. Well, the after that initial, I'm kind of going through the sequence here. After those big meetings, which were in October of 67, I kind of remember this because I was walking up the hill the day of the Dow chemical disorders at the Bascom Hall at Commerce Building. I was walking, I'd had lunch with Bert Fisher, old friend, and we were talking about old business that we'd conducted and so on, and we were in a very leisurely fashion walking up and enjoying this beautiful day, and that's when we first got the first whiff of tear gas.
Mm-hmm.
And first time it really touched me in that respect. Now, I can't altogether remember the sequence here without looking it up, but the university at this time was concerned about laws relating to the TAs, the teaching assistants. It had come about, I think, because in the first riots, some TAs, and I recall the name of Robert Cohen, had been involved, presumably inciting the students to disorder and so on. And I think he was summarily discharged. And then the question came up: How can you discharge a TA under these circumstances? And what were his rights? And the university committee, the general attitude, I think, among the faculty was that TAs, after all, are kind of junior faculty, and they're sort of blanketed under this sort of structure of academic freedom and all those things. And but we got to looking at the legislation, it said nothing about teaching assistants. So the university committee at that stage got busy on a bit of legislation that outlined specifically for teaching assistants their rights and their responsibilities, and basically it was a kind of a chapter that sort of corresponded to the similar things about the faculty.
Sure.
And this was one of the major undertakings of the university committee. Among other things, I recall that we were visited by some young people who wanted to talk about collective bargaining for the TAs. I don't remember the name of the girl, but the two men there were Bob Muhlenkamp and Henry Hazlitt, and both of them have continued on and I think become, basically I think what they did was continue on in the labor union movement from this beginning. But I recall the university committee essentially sitting across the table from these young people and talking to them about the proper role of the TAs, and we had no meeting of minds at all. University committee, with some justification, is considered to be a pretty, mostly representative of the conservative establishment, you see. So these were...
Oh, it is.
Don't you think so?
Well, I'm wondering about this.
Well, it always has been. And there has not been very much radical thinking coming out of the university committee very successfully, in my experience.
And more for the status quo.
I would say so. Which is a pretty important viewpoint to have expressed and to have personified. Well, we had some ideas about the TAs. Our ideas about the TAs, I think, probably are still shared by many members of our faculty. This is that a teaching assistant appointment is basically a kind of an award that you make, something you have to offer promising graduate students as a means of supporting them while they finish their graduate studies. It's not quite like a scholarship. They have to work in a different sort of way, but it's at least in my part of the university, not very much different between a TA and a research assistant. I mean, they're awards that are really tied in with your program as a graduate student. And they are, in some respects, kind of junior faculty. They're people who are doing things that the faculty do, but at another level, at a subordinate level, and they're being paid for it. Not too well, but well enough to keep them in school and so on.
Well, I've heard that in a sense, Wisconsin uses TAs to an extent where other institutions have a lot more instructors than we do.
I think there's sort of been a drift in Wisconsin because the TAs, in the old sense that I'm speaking of, now are viewed more like the TAA officials, the union organizers, wanted to regard them. These young people across the table, they wouldn't have any part of that being junior faculty and having it tied in with the graduate program. What they thought of, these were employees of the university. They were being hired to teach, and they were entitled to the kinds of definition of their jobs that you get in most job definitions, sort of thing. Basically, they wanted what we call a trade union, and we were all horrified at the idea of a trade union in the faculty, and at that time, anyway. And they didn't buy it at all. Well, I don't really remember what happened. I can polish that one off. We worked at that problem quite a bit and wrote up a chapter and went through several revisions and had some hearings and everything like that. I'm not sure whether the final version was passed, went up to the faculty and was passed by, adopted by at a faculty meeting or not. But in any case, it just lay in a kind of a limbo, because by that time the TA were organized and everything we had written was essentially irrelevant to the contract the university had. I don't remember very much of what else was going on in the university committee at that time until the disorder showed up. There was a fairly quiet period, I think, for a short time until the end of the year. Alden White, the former secretary of the faculty, died in November of that year. And from then on, for a matter of, until I took over a couple of years later, the office actually was vacant, and it was and the acting secretary was Douglas Dales, who is now acting secretary again. For that, I would notice, though, mention here that Gene Cameron was one of the people who was most interested in getting a faculty senate established in place of the old faculty meetings. Now, there were a lot of people who were interested in this. It wasn't just Gene, but Gene was chairman of the university committee, which carries certain opportunities, you see, for this sort of thing. We did have a committee of the whole discussion in early 1968 on the desirability of having faculty senate. It wasn't much of a discussion, it sort of petered out, but back in those days, there was still some talk about substituting a faculty senate for a faculty, for the regular system of faculty meetings that we had. In that year, also, looking back to see what else we'd done, we had a big discussion of parking policy, which is one of the standard topics that get the faculty interested. We had some discussions of this abortive Chapter 10D dealing with the teaching assistants, and then we had a special meeting in March of 1968, a meeting that went until 10:30 p.m., with 785 people there on the Merman Committee report. This was Sam Merman's committee dealing with modes of response to interruption of university services or some such title. And in April, we also had a special meeting, which was a committee of the whole discussion of the impact of the war in Vietnam. There were, of course, many people who were very concerned about the Vietnam War, and this was a special meeting strictly on that, on the impact of the Vietnam War on the University of Wisconsin. That was another evening meeting.
Mm-hmm. Of course, this is one of the student things they were protesting. part of. It was all related.
It's interesting to look back and try to recall how I reacted personally to some of these things that were going on, and how I now view some of these things. It's now quite obvious that the war in Vietnam was something really to be concerned about, and we all should have been in there. And I think some of our attitudes at that time were that this is war in Vietnam is a terrible thing, but after all, it is not really the responsibility of the university faculty. I now think that it was something that involved us all. We don't have any kind of an institution that's set up to deal with wars in Vietnam. So where else would you go other than universities, where people by and large do more thinking, and where they see more in terms of principles, concepts, policy. Where they are, I think, tend to be a little more open-minded and more receptive to new ideas. And so I'm not surprised that the university took a considerable leadership in this sort of thing. I think they had a role in getting that horrible affair stopped sooner or later.
Well, looking back, it does seem this, but it's viewing universities as a force for national political change.
Well, this was not the way we had regarded. Some of us had regarded the role of the university at the time this happened. So I suppose one of the things that has come out of the Vietnam War is a little different concept of what a university does in society as a whole. Of course, another thing that came out of it was universities have come under some suspicion and considered they're now taken much less for granted than they were back in those days. Well, we had meetings in the Vietnam War, and then we got into, before the end of the year, we got into a large special meeting in which we undertook to develop a new student disciplinary procedure. I suppose this was one of the main concerns all year long, some kind of a policy for disciplining students for the kinds of things students had been doing in that particular year. And this came out of the Merman Committee, and this came out of the Crow Committee, and it came out of the University Committee, and a lot of, so we had a number of things that then went into our laws and regulations of the eventually went into the laws and regulations of the university.
I have a feeling there must have been a lot of pressure to do something like this, because I know that from around the state generally, the university lost a lot of support because of the student protests. There must have been some kind of pressure to do something about this situation.
Well, nobody knew exactly what to do, certainly, but it was also obvious that what we had been doing wasn't adequate, so we were trying for something new. Now, this was a kind of an interesting period, and I might develop that meeting, which was in May of 68. The Merman Committee and the Crow Committee both came out with reports with a number of recommendations. These were fairly large committees, and they were working sort of independently, and they had students on them, so at least the Merman Committee, and I'm not sure about the Crow Committee, had majority and minority reports. The majority would tend to be the ones in which the students were involved, students and some of the faculty, and the minority report, which would in general tended to be the more conservative establishment view, was often the faculty members, a few of the faculty members. I'm not sure this is entirely true, but I think it was true in the Merman Committee report.
So there were students on these committees?
Oh yes, there were students on them. We got a whole mass of reports, long reports, several parts, published and distributed widely. Majority and minority reports, and a lot of recommendations, majority and minority recommendations, and The university committee took it on itself to look all these over and decide how it thought its recommendations should come out. And so we formulated, the university committee formulated a bunch of recommendations, which we announced in advance of the meeting, said that the university committee will bring in these recommendations for policy. Well, they were some considerable departure from the Crow Committee report and the Sam Merman Committee report. And these were published, and they were distributed to the faculty. This faculty meeting was to be on Monday, which would have been the 13th of May. On that Sunday, we had an emergency meeting called with the University Committee, a meeting with Sam Merman and with James Crow, who in effect laid down the law to us. They said, look, you come out with some recommendations that are not ours, and we will oppose them in front of all the faculty. And basically, they made the University Committee change its recommendations. So we came out with some changed recommendations in time for that meeting. And these were, thinking back, I think it's probably accurate to say ours were the very conservative, traditional sort of approaches to some of these things, and the Sam Merman and Jim Crow committees, having been dealing with students and pretty widely on a lot of these things, were somewhat more liberal. They were further departure from tradition than ours were, certainly. And they backed those two people, Jim Crow and Sam Merman, in a very nice way, just backed the university committee down on it, said, we can't get away with this sort of thing. We'll oppose it, and we'll muster the forces, and we'll beat you on it. So we did make these changes. Well, at that meeting, we had, as usual, we'd have a whole series of recommendations, like six of them, and then somebody would present one, and somebody would present another, and so on. What we did was go on down through. I presented one, and it was fortunate it got through all right. It had to do with student court, as I recall it. But down toward the end, some of those were not accepted by the faculty in this faculty meeting. The university committee got beat on some of its recommendations to the faculty. It was no longer all powerful. And it impressed me at the time, because I know a fellow who went out of the went out of that meeting. I know him, and I have quite a lot of respect for him. I didn't know him much at the time, but...
Who's that?
That was Bob Marsh. March. In physics. When he... walking out of the meeting, I think it was Bob. I have him identified with it. But he was full of glee. We beat the university committee. This had become one of the goals, you see. One of the faculty was... I don't know, it was so much divided and sort of fragmented, but nobody knew what to do, and there were quite a number of young members of the faculty that had views that we regarded as somewhat radical, you know, siding with the students and that sort of stuff. And for them, I think the university committee had been a kind of a symbol, and for them it was some kind of an achievement to beat the university committee and the supporters of the university committee. So that was happening back as far as May 1968. Well, the next year I became chairman of the university committee, and we were at that time we were meeting on the matter of student disciplinary policy on student discipline, student conduct discipline. We had a structure, a temporary structure that has since been abandoned, but we never did solve this problem of how properly to discipline students for misconduct of one kind or another. We had the meetings on that sort of a subject. We were spending quite a lot of time on revising the whole list of regulations of the university, the faculty ones. There was a committee under David Fellman that recodified, and in fact they rewrote and put new, this was not merely editing, it was changing the rewriting and changing the rules to some extent. So we were running quite a few of those things through the faculty during those in that period. By February, let's see, Well, it's one other thing. We had a proposal that surfaced a couple of times then, which was beaten back and which has never been heard of since. But I think it also represented dissatisfaction or distrust of the faculty meeting structure. The argument was, here we have a faculty meeting and a few members of the faculty come in and decide something, sometimes by a narrow margin, that affects all the faculty, and we shouldn't have it that way. So what we will do is have an arrangement by which all questions of any substance or meaning get sent around to be voted on by mail, a mail ballot to go to all members of the faculty. Reed Bryson was one of the people who was pushing this. And it came up two or three times. From a mechanical viewpoint, even at that time I was kind of interested in how these things were done in an office like the office of the secretary of the faculty. From a mechanical viewpoint, that would have been an absolutely horrible, I think from a parliamentary viewpoint too, it would have been a very bad thing. It would mean that you would never have a meeting that decided anything, because everything then would have to go by mail to somebody else to be voted on, like having a perpetual series of referenda on your things.
Pretty unwieldy.
Well, there was something else in that bothered me. I have a feeling that you get a bunch of faculty people together and they sort of gloss over some of the technicalities of these things, and they wanted in there, along with the ballot on how you vote on these questions, they wanted a summary of the arguments on both sides. And they wanted somebody, presumably the secretary, to listen to the arguments and then present the well-balanced presentation of the arguments on both sides. Well,
it sounds impossible.
Well, it wouldn't be impossible, but after 2 months of that, why, you'd cut your throat, I'm sure, or somebody would do it for you, because you never can present these arguments adequately. Anyway, that surfaced in the fall of 1968, and I think it came up again once or twice later on, but it was always forestalled, and we never went anywhere with that. We got a new system, as a matter of fact. In February 1969, there was a student strike on the demands of the black students. We had a meeting on the 10th of February, a regular meeting, which was to be a reconsideration of a chapter of legislation that we'd gone over, and instead we had an unplanned committee, the whole discussion of the student strike and the demands of the black students and so on. This was As the chairman of the university committee, who by law presides at the committee of the whole discussions of the faculty, I was suddenly in the chair for the first time in my experience. I knew nothing about it, and I don't really know what happened. I managed to get through it, but it was quite an experience to have an unplanned meeting of that sort thrust on you, at the last minute. Well, that began, that was on the 10th of February, and that began a period in which we had quite a number, in February of 1969, there was quite a number of meetings dealing with the black students and the black students' demand. Well, apparently the student strike, I don't have the exact dates, was somewhat before the 10th, like the day or two before the 10th of February. By the 19th, we had a special meeting in the Union Theater. This was again the faculty, and we had 1,300 people there. This had a number of special reports dealing with the black students. There was a report of the Committee on Human Rights, of which Lloyd Bitzer was the chairman at the time. Then we had a number of statements by various people in the university picked. The university committee in a meeting like that would tend to set up a kind of a program in which we would ask the president of the Wisconsin Student Association to speak, and we'd ask some other people to speak. I'm not sure that the WSA president talked at this meeting, but we would decide who really ought to be represented. We had Sam Proctor, who was in central administration at the time, and we had members of the black members of our own faculty. I think Charlie Anderson was one, and Donald Harris to make statements. I'm not exactly sure about that particular meeting. But this was a long meeting. This was on the 19th of February, and a big meeting, and we had a lot of these reports. And what they were aiming at, the black students, eventually this all sort of terminated with the development of a new department, the Afro-American Studies Department. But we were sort of working around to that. Well, then this meeting adjourned and met again on the 24th of February at what was a committee of the whole, which I had to preside at. It seemed like there were 1,000 and more people there, but officially we only had 650, but it was still a big meeting, mm-hmm. The committee of the whole. And this was a long and somewhat disorderly experience. Came out all right, I guess. We had at this time, by this time, decided that faculty members and committees had spoken enough, and what we ought to do is hear from some of the students. And so in getting ready for this, the university committee met with some of the student leaders, I guess self-appointed, but in a way that people were recognized as being some leaders in the black student movement here, and set up a program and made arrangements for them to come in and speak. Well, they came in to speak. The only name I have of in my notes here is Willie Edwards, who was one of the leaders. But we had lined up a number of people to speak, including at this time the Dave Goldfarb, who was the chairman, president of the Wisconsin Student Association, and some other people, but also the black students. Mm-hmm. And the meeting started off with looking back now, you see that what we were doing was playing games to some extent. We would tell the black students, well, you can have three people to speak, any three, and they can speak for 10 minutes. Well, they came in with five, and they wouldn't speak unless these other people, third world representatives, could also speak, you see. And there was some question about how long they could speak. If we told them 5 minutes, they wanted 10 or something like that. And these were things that would come in at the last minute. And they came in and announced that they had five people they wanted to speak, and instead of the three. And I said this was out of order, and so they all walked out. And at that stage, here was a meeting without any program. And faculty, there were enough people in the faculty who were disgusted with this whole thing and didn't want to listen to any students and so on, so they wanted to adjourn. Well, we wanted to keep the meeting in session, and we eventually got them back in, agreed to have all five of them speak and so on. I remember there was a lot of very petty stuff going on. Willie Edwards was a kind of a colorful character. He must have been a leader. I don't know what he's done now. But he was wearing a black beret. Well, this infuriated some members of the faculty, who insisted that he take his hat off. We made quite a point of this, and Willie was right in this. Because he said this is, what he didn't say was, well, now look, we have Sikhs and all other kinds of, other nationalities, other racial costumes around the campus, and don't think anything about it. You're on me simply because I'm wearing a black beret, and that has some connotations. But he kept it on. He made his talk, and they all stayed, and it was a 3-hour meeting. And people had a chance to talk. Then we got, in the next month, we had meetings, also large meetings, but they were basically dealing with studies in race relations, and eventually ended up in the formation of this new department, the Afro-American Studies Department. I don't think that was the big excitement that spring, and those meetings were again very large. I have we had meetings of 1,300 official. Our official minutes said 1,300 and 1,262 and so on. So these were These were very large meetings. They were, again, these kinds of meetings in which you don't really function as an efficient legislative organization. It's more a mass meeting of on a subject of general concern. We ended up that year with some, we adopted the proposal for an Afro-American Studies Department, and but we were also concerned about a new non-resident admissions policy that the Regents had come up with. I don't recall now exactly the details here, but the Regents had become concerned about the size of the university, and they were cutting down, and they were doing it in terms of restricting the number of admissions at the freshman level, and our faculty was pretty upset about that, as I think they have some reason to be. But we ended that year, and at that stage, that summer, I became secretary of the faculty.
Is this?
Yep.
Were you appointed or elected?
Oh, I was appointed. The secretary of the faculty, by long tradition, is appointed by the chancellor. They worked the secretary of the faculty in on the search and screen route. That is it was under.
Well, the thing about finding a secretary of the faculty, there would be a search and screen committee which was set up. I had known Ed Young
during the previous year as a chairman of the university committee, and we got along pretty well. So when there was this vacancy that he had to fill, he appointed me. Administratively, the secretary of the faculty is responsible to the chancellor. I asked Bri Curl, my old friend who was then vice chancellor of academic affairs, I said, "Bri, what does it mean to be administratively responsible to the chancellor?" And he said, "Bill, it means that if you don't get along, one or the other of you has to leave."
Your mention of search and screen committee reminds me of something I wanted to talk about probably before we discuss what went on while you were secretary of the faculty. I understand that you were ahead of the committee, the search and screen committee, to appointed by President Harrington to select a chancellor for the Madison campus, who ultimately, as we know, was H. Evelyn Young. Would you talk about how this selection was made?
Well, when I mentioned the search and screen, suddenly I thought of that too, because that was one of the highlights of that period of my history. Bill Sewell resigned during the summer. Early spring, in the late spring or something of that.
Quite unexpectedly, as
it was,
people felt.
I didn't expect it. I remember he called me at home and told me that he was resigning the night before it was announced or something like that. This Fred Harrington was the president. Bill Sewell was the chancellor. Bill resigned. Then Fred, before he announced all of this, wanted to have it all lined up with the procedure for replacing Sewell as a chancellor. So he had gone through the whole search and screen procedure, and he knew it better than I did, but the search and screen procedure called basically for the appointment by the president of a committee under the chairmanship of the chairman of the university committee. And I was it. So that spring, when I had been elected as the chairman of the university committee, suddenly I got this other job, which was, for the time being, it was a much larger, more demanding sort of thing. The search and screen committee for the looking for a chancellor for Madison. This was in May. This was in June, I guess, of '68. A nine-man committee. I can't recall exactly the composition. There were two members of the, there were two deans on it. There were two members of the university committee. There was one student member who was the chairman of, or president of the Wisconsin Student Association, at David Goldfarb. Each of the divisions, as I recall it, put up a member so that they were chosen from the various faculty divisions to give some kind of a distribution. And I thought I would never forget the names of those people. I probably could still remember them. But we spent a lot of time together that summer. We had frequent meetings. We spent a lot of time in setting up a procedure. We tried to anticipate all the kinds of questions that would come up. And we tried to set up a procedure for getting names, for getting information on the various candidates, for voting on them. We had a whole procedure of a number of votes, a number of successive voting on people that established a kind of rating, which we'd get a sort of a ranking of our various candidates over a period of time. Several votes on each person, you see. And we also had a pretty good idea what we were supposed to do as a committee. And as a committee, what we were supposed to do was put up a panel of names, which we were to give to the president. And we were not supposed to pick anybody. We were supposed to give him a set of names, any one of which would be, in our judgment, was qualified to be selected as the chancellor. We have just completed the, at least in the public sense, we've just completed the operations of the new search and screen committee, and there's quite a lot of there's a substantial difference between the way we operated and the way they operated.
Well, I hope you'll explain that.
I'll try to. For one thing, there's a question of confidentiality. We were told that the names that we were to give the president were not to be communicated to anybody else. This was all a confidential matter. We were not supposed to... I don't know that we were told we were not to communicate with the candidates, but at least we didn't do it officially. We did not have any interviews as a committee with any of these people who were mentioned as potential candidates.
So you didn't know whether they'd be interested?
No, we did not get into that question. We did some, I mean, there are ways you inquire around, and I'm sure there was nobody on that list who was not aware that his name had been put up and that he was being under consideration and so on. So we did have some cases, I believe, where people let it be known that they were not interested, so we didn't consider them. The nominations we got, we sent a letter around to all members of the faculty, inviting them to make nominations. And we asked people who made nominations to send along any biographical material they could too, you see. But we did not put the burden on the person making the nomination to make all the case for him. We put the burden on him to tell us the name and identify the man and give, I say man, because at that stage I don't think we had any women put up as candidates.
That's an interesting commentary, isn't it?
I had better check some of these things before it becomes official part of your archives, Donna, because we probably ought to get some of these things straight somewhere in the record. I would say that we did maintain confidentiality. We reported a list of names. And nobody knew for sure who's on the list. They all speculated, I'm sure. There was the same kind of speculation in the newspapers that we've had in the last few months here. But they didn't get the stuff from us. And as far as I know, every member of the committee maintained this confidentiality. Now, a number of months after this, after Ed Young was appointed, I think it was Dave Goldfarb got a little mad about something or other, and he told everything he knew to the Daily Cardinal, which, and so a lot of the stuff, the confidential stuff, was then leaked. But that was after several months. Who cares about it? It was at the time that you were really concerned about it. So we did keep this confidentiality. We did also keep the idea that the search and screen committee was not supposed to pick the chancellor. The search and screen committee was supposed to provide a field of names from which somebody else would make the selection, and which I think is another important principle. Now, I must say that no committee can do this without developing a preference for some people and thinking, well, let's give him three names. It'll be harder for him, you know, to... I think we put up six names for this, as we were asked to do. But there is a tendency in a committee, after having studied all these people, to rely on its own judgment and think this is the person we ought to hire, or the, one of these two, rather than giving them a lot of these others that we think are window dressing or people who really shouldn't have it over, be preferred over our favorite candidates.
So what did you do?
We gave them unranked.
You did.
Well, there'd been a lot of speculation in the papers, and I think the newspapers, one way or another, had mentioned all of the people who were at Madison in the university who were considered as candidates. So one way or another, there'd been some speculation touching on all these people. Now, the favorite candidate, the one with the inside track, was Edwin Young. That's the one with the inside track in the newspapers. And Ed Young was not on the first list that was put out. He was released by the Search and Screen Committee, given to President Harrington.
Now that's interesting.
Well, I've often wondered, really, since I read the newspapers too, and I get some kind of a notion, well, this is obviously one of the candidates you consider. Here was a man who had a long history in the university. He'd been involved in faculty government. He had some responsible administrative jobs. He had originally been appointed as the chairman, at one stage he was appointed chairman of the economics department because they had such a god-awful mess in the economics department. They couldn't straighten it out by themselves. So Ed Young was a man who was put in by the president to straighten that one out. And he did. Of course, he'd been dean of letters and science. Then he went to Maine, where he was president of Maine. He never said to me that it was an unhappy experience, but he left Maine and he came back here as a vice president, where he was, Fred Harrington had brought him back as a vice president, and it was kind of believed that he was now a vice president under Fred Harrington, and Fred was kind of holding him in reserve because he was going to move him into one of these spots when he had the chance.
Well, as I recall Scuttlebutt at the time, it had it that he wasn't happy in Maine.
He did have some trouble. Of course, everybody does, but he had some trouble with appropriations and one thing or another. I'm not sure what all went wrong. It's ancient history now, but Ed is a Maine man, you see, so he's got strong ties with Maine, and I think they still have a place in Maine, or at least a place they go to on vacations and so on up there. Well, Ed, I've wondered why the committee refused to do it. Now, the committee the name was brought up. As I recall it, the name was brought up, and everybody kind of took, well, as foregone conclusion, we're going to okay him. And then you talk about these things, and the longer you talk about any candidate, the more objections to them surface. So there was some discussion of Ed Young and in his administrative style. And it was alleged, and it was absolutely true, as far as I mean, my subsequent experience, absolutely true. One of the problems with Ed as an administrator is you go in to see him with a problem, you talk it over, and you walk out of his office, and then you ask yourself, well, now, what did he say? Did he say yes or no? And I mean, he's not one of these who comes down strong on one side or another and makes it absolutely clear. He's a man who is pretty hard to pin down on a lot of these things. Sometimes it's kind of hard to tell whether he's for or against your proposition, let alone whether he's going to back it, you know. Well, this is true. And I mean, now by experience, I know this is true. This was held up as an objection by some people who had served as departmental chairman when he was dean of LNS. But I kind of guess I think that really What we have here is a kind of an objection, an unvoiced objection a committee gets to the person who is widely touted as a front runner, and the person who's obviously the candidate come up. I mean, you build up a kind of a resistance to being pushed, and the feeling that Fred Harrington was going to appoint Ed Young, and I think that was absolutely true too. Feeling that he was going to do it meant that there wasn't very much point in what we were doing. You see, we were just going through the motions, and we give him Ed Young, why he's going to appoint him, and we wasted the summer on all these meetings. Anyway, they didn't put him on. Ed didn't make the cut. I voted for him. There were two or three other people who voted for him consistently. So there was some support. There was, but there were other people who were unwilling to vote for him. Now the student member, there was only one student member in a committee of nine, so the student member didn't have an awful lot of clout in terms of number of votes, but he did play a role, and I think he had some effect on the way other people voted. Among other things, the student governments all have some kind of connection, so Dave would get in touch with somebody at Iowa State to find out what they thought about Bob Parks, or he would get in touch with these people at Berkeley to find out what they thought about candidates who were coming out of Berkeley and some of the other things. And the students were not very strong for Ed Young, as represented by Dave Goldfrapp. And some of these things must have had effect. Well, the committee finished its work. And at that stage, I had to report to, as soon as the committee had finally done its work and made its decision and instructed me as chairman what I was supposed to do, I had to communicate this to Fred Harrington. And this was kind of an interesting experience. Fred was traveling. He was in Australia. I went up to his office in Bascombe Hall, in Van Hise Hall, a very plush place that most of us don't visit too frequently, so it sort of impresses a guy from South Dakota, you know. I went up there one morning and early and made arrangements to place a long-distance call to Alice Springs, Australia. Alice Springs, as I recall it, is right about in the middle of Australia. It must be hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of miles from anything else, you know. And so I placed a call. I got to a hotel where Fred Harrington was staying, and got the night man. This was, I suppose, midnight or sometime in Australia. And we roused Fred, and I gave him my...
And he got a pencil, I suppose.
Although Fred has a remarkable memory, he probably doesn't write things down, he probably remembers them. And I read off the names, and there was a long pause. He says, "Isn't Ed Young's name on that?" Something like that. I said, "No, it was left off." He said, "Why?" And I said, "Well, there are several, I mean, we talked very briefly about this, but we left off." He said, "Well, in any case, you give this list to Clodius." Now, Clodius's name was one of the candidates on this list. And I said, "I call that attention." And he said, "Well, that's a good point. Well, give it to him anyway." So I got in touch with Bob Clodius right away, gave him the list of names. Then we sat for quite a long time. Fred came back to Madison. And after a while, he got together with me, and I assembled this search and screen committee, and Fred said, "Well, I've taken your list of candidates, and I've gone through it, and this man," he gave various reasons why these various names were disposed of, and what he wanted from us were more names. So at that stage, he left, and we sat in his office up there, as a matter of fact, and we voted to give him the name of Ed Young and somebody else, and it was... it was a tie-in sale. Nobody was very strong for this other person, you see, but we weren't just going to give him Ed Young, you see. And we gave him Ed Young, and first thing you know, Ed was appointed
Ed was appointed chancellor. And I think on the whole he's been a good one. I have had some talks with some other members of the Search and Screen Committee, and we agreed that the objections that we had voiced at the time to Ed Young were absolutely true. That is, he has this administrative style that is in some respects an infuriating one to have to deal with. It's one that once you accommodate to it, why, it works fine, and you get along with it, and it gives you a certain amount of freedom, but it becomes a process of on the basis of your experience with him and your intuition and your sense of rapport and everything, what you decide from the look on his face or from the tone of his voice or something, what he really means by these things, you know, whether he's...
But he doesn't come flat out and he doesn't let you know.
Now, other candidates, I'm sure, were a good deal more decisive in the kinds of things they would say. That is, if you went to them for an answer, well, they'd give you an answer. I think this is true too, from some of those people that I have known subsequently. It was true. You would get an answer from some of them. Of course, what you judge in the long run is how often their answers are right, not whether they make them clear or not.
Well, on that basis, what do you now think of Young's chancellorship?
Well, I've been a very strong supporter of Ed Young. I think he's been, as often now said, tough-minded sort of man. He's taken a lot of rebuffs and kept going without being demolished by them. He never very insistent on getting his own way on any particular thing. He adapts to all kinds of modifications that come in from outside. He decides pretty well how you handle some of these things, how you should handle them, or how whether you accept what it is and go on. He's flexible in that sense. He's always pleased me as being aware of traditions, and I think he's been one of the strongest defenders of faculty government he could possibly have had around here. He's done more for it than the faculty has, I think, for instance, and he's been good in that respect.
Your discussion of the Search and Screen Committee's deliberations in connection with the appointment of Ed Young as Chancellor is especially interesting now that this process is again being gone through with the present Search and Screen Committee, with a Chancellor as yet undecided upon. How does the performance of this committee compare with what you recall from your committee?
Well, of course, I see some differences to begin with. Obvious ones that strike me. This question of confidentiality. Now, I've always bought the idea that when you're talking about getting somebody in to an important administrative post, your dealings along this line ought to be confidential, at least between. I mean, the people who are making the decisions, you see, and the individual, but at least until they get to a certain sort of a stage. Names don't come up as candidates for chancellorship in very unexpected quarters. I mean, pretty near everybody that you think of as a legitimate candidate for chancellor is likely to be on the list, may or may not be. It never surprises you too much, some of the names that show up on these lists, after you really think about it. There are, however, in any of these search and screen committees, a lot of people on that list that never should be there. I mean, they're people, obviously, who are not going to be considered seriously. I don't recall how many we had. I'll look it up and mention and add it to the tape sometime here. But supposing you have 80 names, well, I suppose there are at least 50 of those names that you wouldn't think of twice, that anybody seriously wouldn't think of twice. There are people who are who don't have the qualifications, who don't have the experience, don't have the record, and the ones that you just wouldn't think of twice. Most people wouldn't think of twice. So you don't like to talk about all the people you throw out automatically on the first screening and say,
sure,
this guy's never going to make it. And I don't know that it helps. I have always accepted the idea that, Fred Harrington said he wanted these kept confidential, and it seems to me that whoever is organizing the search and screen process, which is the regents and the president, have the right to lay down some of the rules. And if they say they want it kept confidential, that they don't want you to approach the people, that they don't want you to interview them, that we'll do that if when we get closer, when we narrow down the field, something like that, I accept this all right. Now, the present committee apparently was set up with this kind of charge, and it was accepted by most members of the committee, but not by all. And that, in a sense, is a kind of a departure. It's one of those things you don't really expect. You think that if a person is named to a committee, and then the committee makes some decisions about how it's going to operate, it's going to keep these names confidential, that you as a member of the committee are bound by the committee decision.
I would suppose so.
You either put up with it and comply with it, as they did in my committee, or you get off the committee, but you no longer have the right as an individual to say, I don't agree and I'm going to do it differently. But somebody obviously has been leaking as freely as through a sieve from this search and screen committee with many of the details as soon as anything comes up, and leaked to reporters. So
well, even lists of names. I've been really quite astonished to find these in the paper.
Well, now, I don't know, of course, whether these are accurate or not, but I suspect that the Cap Times reports are accurate, pretty accurate on the names and on some of the discussion going on. Because I think there are members of this committee, must be members of this committee, who call the Cap Times as soon as they get out of a committee meeting and give them a whole poop. Well, this is not the way you play the game by the old rules, you see.
Certainly not.
But it may be the way you do it now. It does raise a question of whether these things should be kept confidential. We've had a big flurry of excitement about secrecy in government, and there's a lot of pressure. Again, the newspapers, Cap Times primarily, that is insisting on no secrecy in government, and why don't you conduct your search in front of the whole entire public? And I don't know whether this is right or not, but it's a different principle. I don't think it's right, to be honest with you, but that's the way things are going. Well, that's one of the big differences. Now, the other big difference, and I can only get at this indirectly by thinking of at least one person that I'm surprised is not on that list, I think this committee is determined to pick the chancellor. I think they're doing it in a way, along with releasing this information and so on, they're doing it in a way that's going to greatly restrict the choice that the chancellor has, President Young now, and the Board of Regents. So I understand that he will receive the list, he'll make his recommendations to the Board of Regents, and then the Board of Regents and will make the appointment, or will at least announce it. And so this again is a difference in the role of the Search and Screen Committee. I think they're determined as far as they possibly can to get Irv Shayne as the next chancellor, and Irv would be all right. He's qualified. But I don't think this is a role of the faculty. And I have a kind of a strong feeling that this is going to be, like other things we've done, this is going to harm the faculty in the long run.
Why?
We have managed to maintain a very strong voice in the selection of our major administrative officers, primarily through the search and screen process. Now, there have been lots of regents, at times who have questioned this. They have wanted regents on the search and screen committee. We've kept them off. We said, this is not your business. At this stage, we pick some names. You're the people who are making the decision. Which of those names are going to be the ones that you're going to appoint? we've maintained a kind of an integrity within the kind of a, within the faculty framework of the search and screen process. And but it's also part of a selection process in which part of it is a search and screen to get the panel of the names, and this is a faculty responsibility. Somebody at the other end, the regents, are the ones who make the final decision, along with the president in here in a very important role in between. And I think if the search and screen committee comes up with a list of three names or four names, and if some of those people resign, take their names off the list, which at this stage I would not think is improbable, then the regents will be have a proper reason for saying this is not an adequate job. We will resort to a different process.
So you think there's a chance that they might react this way?
Yeah, I think that if you breach confidentiality, and if you that is if you don't play it by the rules that are sort of understood to be the rules, with the balance of powers between faculty and regents and so on, if you abuse your opportunity here, I think in the long run you're going to find out who runs the university, whether it's the regents or the faculty. And it wouldn't surprise me if it turned out to be the regents. So I don't know about this. Now, this is all I can think of is Steve Chafee as the chairman of this committee, and I'm glad that I had the committee I had and operated when I did and so on, because it was still enough work and enough worry, but it went all right. And I think that unless Steve is part of this is part of this move, he's pretty distressed about the way this committee has sort of handled its operations. I don't think it's a very impressive demonstration part of the committee.
Well, even the fact that it's supposed to have been confidential has been noted in the newspaper, but it's also clearly
weren't in favor of being confidential, and they agree with that question. Yeah. Well, I imagine that the majority of the committee are pretty clear on some of these points, but the minority are not bound by any committee decisions and don't feel any obligation that way. Now, that's something that you get. You either accept this or you don't when you, along with the kind of the committee operation. We've had some of it when you go way back. I spoke with the minority and the majority and the minority reports on some of these controversial issues. You get on some of these major issues, nobody's got the answer, and you can't expect to get agreement. But you appoint a committee with the idea that it's going to examine all the sides and it's going to come out with some kind of a committee judgment. What good does it do the faculty to appoint a committee that comes out with a number of different judgments? We already have those. What we want is the balance here. We want a central position that we can work with. But in some ways, I think that when a committee comes out with a minority report, as we have had in some of these in the past, it represents a breakdown of the committee. It hasn't really performed its function. It sharpened up some issues, but we had the issues before, whether they were that sharp or not.
Well, it will be interesting to see what develops. I wonder if you'd tell me a little bit about the office of the Secretary of the Faculty as it was when you took office.
I had been aware, as chairman of the University Committee, I'd worked quite close with Doug Dales, then acting secretary. I'd been aware of what that office does, and I had quite a lot of hope in the future of this office and good expectations, and saw it as a pretty important role. Historically, the office of the secretary was set up by appointment. This is never anything but an administrative position that was designated, a duty that was assigned by the administrative head. I don't know whether Alden White had ever been appointed by a chancellor, but he had grown up in the job and he'd kept it for many years. It was an administrative job. It has certain ceremonial functions. A secretary of any organization is the person who writes up the minutes, takes the notes at the meetings, makes the arrangements for meetings, issues notices of meetings, keeps the faculty documents connected with meetings, helps to prepare the agenda, keeps the kind of historical record of the faculty. Now that doesn't go very far. That isn't too much in itself. What we've had always has been an office in which there was a person designated as secretary of the faculty, and that office did a lot of other things that were not connected with the official and ceremonial functions of a secretary of an organization. For instance, way back in Alden White's early days, that office handled the room assignments for the whole campus. And they handled the timetable. And Doug Dales has been in on some of that back in the days when they were doing it in the office. Well, of course, the university got so large and complex that, particularly in modern times, the way we now think about these things, it all had to be computerized, and this is handled by the Space Management Office and Timetable Office. I mean, they have separate establishments for handling these things now. But once those are handled, on a set of cards in Alden White's office. So now why he was doing it? Well, the office was there and it had the people, and he was a good one to turn over this kind of an assignment to. Alden was the secretary of the Chancellor's Administrative Council, and he was a member as well as secretary of the Administrative Council, and this was quite an important group at one time. The secretaries of the faculty office also had all of the records, and I mean by that personnel records. We had the list of the faculty. This was originally, at the time before I took over, it was handled on IBM cards by Mrs. Florence Kappen, who was there for quite a long time. They handled their own records, and in the IBM cards and in that record, they had a lot of personnel information, not only lists of faculty and their titles and their departments and this kind of information, but they had some other information that got on there, personnel information. Some of it was on the cards, and some of it was on another system that we maintained. We have in there, we know when these people were appointed in the first place, their dates of promotion. We know what kind of degrees they have from what institution, and all kinds of things of that sort. That you think of as being a kind of a faculty record. Whether they're married, which is something we no longer concern ourselves with, and so on. Date of birth, of course. Well, we had a very substantial records operation, and this was the only personnel records on the campus, I guess you'd have to say for all employees. They never had anything resembling this for the classified civil service employees. Never had this on data processing form. We kept it for not only for the faculty, but what used to be called the non-faculty academic, but are now called academic employees. So we kept a lot of this sort of thing. Well, now this records operation was a pretty big one, and it's kind of the root of a lot of other things you do. In that office, we kept track of the health examinations. You see, state law requires that everybody have a health examination at the time they're employed, and they have a periodic recheck to be sure they're not coming down with tuberculosis or something like that. Well, we have to keep this record, and we have to do the follow-up, and you base this on your faculty records, you see. I mean, these are the names that you work with and where you keep the record. We've had the...
Well, that must be a lot of work if people are as slow as I am in getting their records back.
It takes most of the time of a girl we have who works part-time. And raises some interesting questions. Here's a regulation, but what happens if they don't abide by it? Well, what happens if they don't abide by it is that you don't do anything about it. We had a flurry at one stage at which faculty members refused to have x-rays. And I guess this is for a reason. At least some of them felt very strongly about the x-rays, and so they wouldn't have them. I discussed this with Ed Young, and basically Ed said, well, that's an interesting thing, but don't tell me about it. And because he didn't want to know, because what are you going to do about it? You can't fire somebody because he refuses to have an x-ray. You don't have any disciplinary, the state law provides no penalties or anything like that. So what do you do? We kept track. That's
well, there's a skin test, I think.
There's a skin test now, which has gotten away from that in part, although, as you say, people are slow in doing it. Well, we did this. We issued ID cards. I'm putting some of this in the past tense because this has either been changed or it's in the process of change or the prospect that it's going to be changed. We've issued ID cards for many years. And these are basically cards in which you type down the information that you want. You type the person's name and you type their title and you make him up a card all of his own, and it's signed by the secretary of the faculty, and he carries this around in his billfold. People who've been on the faculty for a long time like to carry cards that were signed by Alden White. I've got one myself. And in principle, you see, you issue the card once. Because if you are appointed as a professor, you stay being a professor until you quit being a professor. So this card is good indefinitely. Now, we've done that on the basis of our records. So easy to get on sidetracks here. But this has offended some people. In the first place, they think that a card that is good indefinitely is not reliable. How can you tell about the man who's carrying a card who no longer is a professor? Well, there aren't very many of those. That would be my answer. And what difference it make if he does carry the card? You see, I can't really believe it's a very serious problem. But they have thought that what we ought to do is issue cards that are periodically verified, the way the student identification cards are. Well, now the students, these are the picture cards that are required by students. Now, of course, they go through a line once every semester. Every time they register, you have a chance to verify the students. I mean, at that stage, when you register, you verify. That's good for that semester, you see. Faculty doesn't do that. All I can say to some of these people who want to change this, do you imagine that you can issue a call and have 2,400 members of the faculty come down here to get their cards identified by you? I know they wouldn't do it. Well, this kind of an ID card function has been part of it. We have had attached to our office also the mailroom and information office in Bascom Hall, which is a pretty active place because all the mail for Bascom Hall comes in there. Then we distribute it. We also are open to the public and provide information on all kinds of things, like how you get refunds from those canteen machines downstairs to bulletins of the graduate school and other things that people ask for. Now, in addition to that, there's one other part that's quite important, and this is this is what I like to call the committee services. What we do is provide staff in support of some of the major committees, primarily the divisional committees and the university committee. Now, this is something new since when I took office. At the time I took office, it had been customary for the chancellor to support the university committee, for instance, like Jean Cameron, by paying the salary, part of the salary, of somebody who was working for Cameron already. Or somebody pay part of the salary of a secretary who would work for Cameron in connection with the university committee, often in the office of the chairman, and also to buy a little equipment that Cameron would want to use as a chairman of the university committee, buy some, and then we'd install that in his office. Then you get a new chairman, and you'd have to make new arrangements. You'd have to find a new secretary for him, and you'd have to buy, by way of equipment. This is not very large, considering the amount of time and effort that the committee puts in on these things. It certainly is not very large, but I remember that Cameron needed a bigger table. He needed a table that was big enough to get six people around it in his office. So Bill Sewell, I guess it was at the time, bought him a table that was big enough to put in for six people, and we put it in his office, and it's still there. And, well, this is one thing that I with Ed Young's approval, accomplished when I first came in. We set it up there, and I think it's a better system. Now, we do the same thing with the divisional committees. Before we used to pay, the office of the secretary of the faculty would pay part of the salary, like half of the salary, of secretaries around the campus that we never even saw, never even knew who were. They were, would be, I'd ask our girls, who is so-and-so, and they'd say, well, she's a secretary down in engineering school in his office, and that's, we're paying part of her salary for the divisional committee. Instead of doing it that way, instead of having a set of records that went with the chairman finished his term of duty, and then he would either send his material as he was supposed to the archives, or some of it he'd pass on to somebody else, or some of it he'd keep for himself. We set up an office, a permanent office there, with a girl who is called the coordinator of the divisional committees, and she's had secretarial help, and it's been kind of a permanent thing.
Is this up in Bascom too?
That's up in Bascom. Those are a couple of changes we made. I guess those are most of the official functions of the office of the secretary and the faculty. Now, when I took over, Jim Cleary was the Chancellor for Academic Affairs, and Jim was doing quite a lot for the office of the Secretary of the Faculty. Remember, Alden White had died, Doug Dales was acting secretary. Jim was taking a very considerable role in the office of the secretary. I think if we had any personnel problems, and we didn't have too many in that time, in those days, I think Jim would take some of the leadership in doing what needed to be done in terms of personnel for the office. Jim was doing the job of organizing the faculty committees, which is a big one, and I'll get back to that. When I took over, Jim told me, now don't underestimate this. He says, this will take you a solid month to get these things done. Every year it's going to take that. I mean, it's a big one. Big job like that. Jim was also taking quite a role. He was trained as a parliamentarian. You know, he's one of the authors or one of the editors of the revision of the Roberts Rules of Order. And Jim was.
He was
active parliamentarian. He liked it, and what he would do is make up a kind of a script for the chancellor in advance of every meeting, explaining just the order in which things are supposed to take place in the meeting and calling his attention to potential problems and things like that. Well, I took over those functions pretty much from Cleary. The committees deserve some special mention because we have a lot of committees. At one stage, I think I used to count 120 committees or something. And we're talking about committees at the university level, not counting the departmental committees and even the college committees, but we have a lot of committees at that higher level with a lot of faculty members on them. Some of them are elected by the faculty, some of them are appointed by the university committee. Great diversity. Many of them are appointed by the chancellor. They are university level, which is about all you can say for them, but they may be particular interests. For instance, we've had a committee on the Atlas for Wisconsin for many years. Art Robinson in the geography department's been chairman. Well, this is a committee that's been concerned with developing an atlas for the state of Wisconsin, and they've published one, and it's been active, and they've had representatives from a number of departments and from outside the university and so on. And now that's a very specialized, special interest committee, but that's a committee that somebody takes charge of. When I took over the office of secretary, I began to write all of the letters of appointment. They came out of my office. I signed them. I did them. I said, the Chancellor Young is asking that you serve, you see. I mean, I did them in his name, but out of my office were all the letters of appointment. And there's, we're talking about 900 or